Welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name's Jeff Mann, and I'm the founder and the editor of sleepjunkies.com. And at Sleep Junkies, we cover the whole conversation on sleep. So we talk about the health and the science aspects. We talk about the culture of sleep. We talk about the sleep industry. We talk about interesting new sleep products. Pretty much if there's an interesting topic and it's got anything to do with sleep, we'll cover it. And today's podcast is going to be all about the topic of CBTI, which stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia. And the reason we're going to talk about CBTI today is hopefully dispel a few myths, hopefully be a bit of an explainer, a bit of an education to anyone that's looking for an effective treatment for insomnia. It's a cognitive and a behavioral therapy. So it's about changing your behavior and changing your thinking rather than taking a medication. So on the other end of the line, we're going to talk to somebody who's trained at a very high level to be qualified as a CBTI practitioner, as a chartered psychologist. And we're going to talk about what CBTI is. We're going to talk about what it involves. We're going to talk about the background. We're going to talk about what CBTI isn't. And hopefully you'll go away with a much better understanding of what it could do for you if you're suffering from sleep problems. If you're liking the Sleep Junkies podcast, don't forget to subscribe, leave us a little review on iTunes. You can also check us out on the website, sleepjunkies.com, and we're all over social media, Sleep Junkies on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Pinterest. And that's it for the introduction. Really hope you enjoy this episode. On with the show. We're here with Dr. Lindsay Browning. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the discussion, can you describe to our listeners who may not have heard of you exactly what you do and what your organisation Trouble Sleeping does?
Yeah, sure. I'm Dr. Lindsay Browning and I'm a chartered psychologist. I studied insomnia at the University of Oxford with Professor Alison Harvey, who was a pioneer in looking at cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. So I worked with her doing my doctoral thesis, looking at worry and rumination in insomnia. And at that time, when I graduated, was in 2006, there were literally 10 people in the United Kingdom who were doing CBTI for insomnia, looking at helping people with their insomnia by looking at their cognitions and behaviors about sleep. And it was such a hugely important issue. So at that point, I set up Trouble Sleeping, which is the company that I use to run services whereby I help people with cognitive insomnias. And I say cognitive insomnias rather than insomnia caused by pain or caused by sleep apnea or some kind of REM disorder, a sort of more medical insomnia, because those are the ones that historically have had lots of money put into them, being investigated, because you can treat them with equipment and medicine. But a normal insomnia, which affects 90%+ of people with trouble sleeping, has been historically not had lots of focus on. So I set up Trouble Sleeping in 2006, seeing clients, and I see them either face-to-face or somewhere on the phone or via Skype. Following that, I've moved abroad and lived in Singapore and America, and back in the UK and doing my Trouble Sleeping business again.
Great. I'm going to big you up here a bit, Lindsay. So you studied at Oxford, and Oxford is, in the States, you'd call it an Ivy League university. The reason I'm bringing this up is because, you know, you've been to arguably the top university in the country. You've studied with one of the pioneers in this field.
Yep.
And, you know, you're a sleep expert, and I don't think there's any question about that. But we're having this discussion where a lot of people are getting on this trending sleep bandwagon and calling themselves experts. And I don't want to go into this too much, but I want to stress the importance, because you're trained to see people and patients, whereas a lot of people will be taking people on as clients and trying to solve their sleep issues. And as you said, as we had this discussion, you know, you've looked some of these people up, and what are their credentials? Well, they're a mum.
Yeah, that is
and
true.
Of course, you know, we love mums.
Mm-hmm. I'm a mum.
And that's great, but that doesn't give you the qualification to see patients in a professional setting.
I think it's very difficult for people, because I'm sure that there are plenty of sleep experts without formal qualifications who are doing an excellent job. That they've done their own research and they're probably giving great advice. However, the trouble for the average person seeking help is that you don't know without a government regulated body or some kind of agreed criteria for seeking help for sleep, then they don't know whether they're getting somebody who may just be a mum, but they might be great and might give great advice versus someone who's just a mum or just a dad or just Joe Bloggs down the street who is giving advice that isn't based on science and actually may be damaging or harmful. When I see clients, I rule out medical problems that they might be undergoing, which is really important because the worst thing would be to treat someone's insomnia in the way that we're going to discuss later. But actually, their real problem is medically caused. And if you're treating the insomnia, you could be making that medical problem worse with really disastrous consequences. So I think that's really important to do your research when you are looking at getting help, to make sure that the person you're speaking to is really, do they really seem like they're qualified to help you?
Yeah, it's exactly what you said. So we're going to be talking about CBTI. Again, it's another big buzzword. And it's interesting you say back in 2006, there was 10 people in the UK.
Yeah. It was when we're going to sleep conferences, and there wasn't the money or interest in doing it because it's a talking therapy as opposed to something that you can make a lot of money selling a piece of equipment or medicine. But obviously, now that the CBTI has been proven to be so effective over a longer period of time, and with the society looking at sleep and seeing how absolutely vital it is at the moment, that people are thinking, okay, we do need to look at it and deal with it and help people. So now it's become a lot more mainstream, which is fantastic. So CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, has been used for a long time for the anxiety disorders and depression, whereby if people have anxious thoughts, they can worry too much about anxieties, and cognitive behavioral therapy looks at your cognitions and your behavior and looks to change those to help you to become less anxious, less depressed. So CBTI is like that, but for insomnia?
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. Let me pause you there. Sleep problems, they've generally been medicalized, and we think of medicine, we think of pills. We think of treatments and we think of surgeries and we think of going to the doctor and the doctor will say, do this, a medical intervention. CBTI is a talking therapy, but it's also a behavioral therapy.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot of people out there, certainly this was my view before I got to know about CBTI, you know, well, that's therapy, that's going to see someone and talk to someone, but I've got a medical problem, I've got insomnia, mm-hmm. I don't need to go and talk to someone, how's that going to help me? So I think it's important to talk about this in really basic terms, because one of the reasons CBTI has been adopted, it's been proven to be that effective. It's not this concept of going to see a counsellor. I don't know, let's say you had some relationship problems and they might talk about your relationship and then you go away and think about it. I mean, CBTI, it's not a magic bullet, but it's at least, or if not more, effective than sleeping pills in regards to long-term sleep problems.
So the difference between seeing a counsellor if you're unhappy and you want to talk to somebody about your feelings versus CBTI is that CBTI is very prescriptive. It's very scientific. It's following a group of rules, and basically when you come and see a practitioner or somebody to help you with your sleep with CBTI, they're going to look at your sleep in a factually scientific way, analyze it and say, right, what you're doing here is right, what you're doing there is wrong, change this, start doing this, stop doing this. They give you a whole list of things to change to make your sleep better. Whereas when you see a counsellor, there is no counsellor you're going to see who is going to say, well, your boyfriend sounds like an idiot, you should leave him, and your job's a bit stressful, so look for a new one. That's not how counselling works. It's patient-led. So you cannot do both things at once. You can't be giving counselling at the same time as CBTI because they're two completely different things. CBTI is so prescriptive and you have to tell someone what to do. So when I see clients, if their primary problem is that they have post-traumatic stress disorder or they're chronically depressed, then I tell them, I'm not the person you should be speaking to right now. And I refer them on to a specialist who can help them with their post-traumatic stress or their chronic, their, you know, depressive disorder, because that's the frontline thing. I only see people where insomnia is their primary issue.
Thanks for that. That's a really good distinction you've made there. So this idea of counseling and therapy and CBT as a therapy, CBT is prescriptive. It's telling you, you need to, yes, do this. Whereas a counseling thing, mm-hmm, is, it's kind of, a lot of times it's more a reflective space, isn't it? And you're thinking,
yeah,
about the conversation.
And
the conversation.
It's really, counseling is hugely valuable. I'm not saying it's not, because it absolutely is. It's amazing for someone who needs to talk things through. It's just, it's not the same thing as CBTI, which is specifically looking at your sleep and changing it to make it better.
Action points, isn't it?
Yes.
I just want to go back to the origins. It's got quite an interesting history, isn't it? I was doing a bit of studying philosophy just on my own, you know, just some reading. And I was interested to read that CBTI, that the roots are based in very ancient ideas going back to the Greeks thousands of years ago, of Stoic ideas about recognizing your thoughts and recognizing how your thoughts influence your behavior.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, one of the key points of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia or for depression is that when you're in a situation that is troubling you or you're thinking about a lot, then you tend to have attentional bias to those things. So for example, if a couple are having trouble conceiving a child, they will see babies everywhere. They will look on TV and almost every advert they see will be for a baby or for diapers, or they'll walk down the street and see pregnant people because they're looking out for it. Their attentional bias is about babies. If you are depressed, your attentional bias is about depressive thoughts. So you'll remember bad times and you'll think about something that's going to happen in the future and think, oh, it's probably not going to work out because nothing works out for me. Everything's hopeless. And your cognitions are all to do with that negativity. The same thing applies to insomnia. If when you have trouble sleeping, your attentional bias is your concern for your lack of sleep. And so you're worried about, if I don't sleep tonight, then my job performance tomorrow will be affected. I look in the mirror and I see extra wrinkles because I haven't slept. I'll drop a cup and you'll think, oh, that's because I'm so clumsy because I haven't been sleeping. You're looking inside your brain at what you're attending to, what you're thinking about, actually changes your behavior. Because at that point, you will, if you're depressed, you might not go out for the day because you'll think, well, it's pointless. I'll be terrible. I won't make friends. I won't have a good day. So you don't go out. Or with insomnia, you might not go for that new job or that promotion because you think, well, there's no point because I'm not sleeping. I'm not doing my best. I won't even do that. And before you know it, your actual life is being changed because of your attentional bias.
So it's paying attention to the negative thoughts as opposed, yes, to the negative thoughts are causing the negative outcomes.
Yeah, exactly. By paying attention to those negative thoughts, you give them power and then you'll make choices based on them. And also paying attention to the negative thoughts will increase your anxiety. So with insomnia, with sleep, you know, sleep happens when we're relaxed. Sleep doesn't happen if we concentrate really hard and we try our best and we're really tense and we're trying to sleep. If you want to pick up a table, then that's going to work. You concentrate and you really try to pick up this heavy table, that'll work. But it doesn't work with sleep. So if you're stressing and thinking about sleep and you're really worried about your lack of sleep and how important sleep is and how you must sleep, then your anxiety levels start to increase. And the more anxious you are, the less likely you are actually to sleep as well. So it has, not only does it have behavioral consequences on your, what you choose to do during the day, but it also has physiological consequences on your body itself by increasing your stress levels.
Yeah, it's incredibly complex how all these things interact. And I'm lucky not to have suffered from sleep problems historically, but I have had a couple of times in my life, and I distinctly remember that state of being in bed and my mind just racing and racing and racing and going in circles and trying to get these thoughts out of my head. It's not working, and it's like I can't get to sleep. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky that, you know, these things have only happened to me once or twice in my life, but some people have this as an ongoing thing. So I think this is where CBTI has come to the fore, because it gives you tried and tested methods for actually targeting these things. And we're going to go into the nuts and bolts of how that works in a little bit. Can you explain how it's kind of been adopted as a, let's say, a frontline treatment or as a recommended first line treatment in lots of places in the world now, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it has. Yeah, the NICE guidelines, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence in the UK, for example, suggest that if you have an ongoing insomnia, that the first line of attack, the first thing you should do is to seek cognitive and behavioural interventions for that insomnia much before looking at pharmaceutical methods. So before you start having sleeping pills, to look at your cognitive and behavioural aspects of sleep. But unfortunately, there aren't loads of practitioners that they're getting a lot more, like we say, that the world is changing and people are seeing how important it is. So there are becoming more and more people being trained, which is great, but there still aren't loads of them. So actually, even though the NICE guidelines say that's what you should do, reality is that GPs often don't know where to put somebody, where to let someone turn to. So they might give them sleeping pills instead. But luckily, yeah, there are things like computerized CBT delivery, which we'll probably talk about, which are another option that you can have.
Do you know what the situation is in the States?
The States is a lot ahead of us. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine, for example, there is an exam in the States that you can take to be certified. I can't remember the exact terminology, sorry, but there's an exam you take there to be qualified. There are a lot more sleep clinics in America. They've been ahead of us on that zone. So in America, they're a lot more geared up for providing CBTI. But of course, it depends on your health insurance. It's nothing is free. I lived in the States. I lived in Atlanta, Georgia for just under 4 years and moved back in 2005 to the UK. So I had experience of the American health system out there.
So whereas in the past, it may have been the case that your doctor, your physician, your health professional may have recommended sleeping tablets, sleeping pills, pharmaceuticals. Now it's CBTI.
Yes.
So this is how important CBTI has become over the last couple of decades, let's say. I mean, and it is a very recent thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, before I left the UK to go and live abroad and came back, it's a different country with regards to sleep, which is amazing. It's brilliant. I'm really pleased.
Well, one of the things that's happened to help that situation, and of course, I think it's a way for governments and health bodies to actually spread the cost of this.
Yep.
Technology has kind of come into this CBTI world, and now there are loads and loads and loads and loads of apps in particular, online programs. And in the UK, there's a thing called Sleepio, which people may or may not be aware of. Well, it's available worldwide because it's an app. But Sleepio, they've done a licensing agreement with the NHS, which is the National Health Service in the UK. So that's one way of getting CBTI. So whereas before you'd have to pay for Sleepio, you can now get it for free.
Yes.
As an insomnia treatment. And there are obviously other apps and other online programs you can do. But it is something you can either choose to do with a person such as yourself or in a group or on your own with an app.
Yeah. Or with a book.
Or with a book, yeah.
Yeah, so at least there are many ways of getting the help in different delivery systems. And like you say, I think there's evidence to show that one-on-one therapy is absolutely the gold standard best way of delivering it. However, it's very expensive because you're paying a person for their time for a minimum of sort of 6 hours. Whereas an app, you can enable everyone to be able to have that help. And the success rates of online or self-directed CBTI, it's pretty good. It's been shown to be not so great in older people and unemployed people, and they respond better to sort of therapist-delivered CBTI. But and people who need that little bit of extra one-on-one encouragement. But it's been shown that CBT for anxiety disorders delivered by computerized delivery is very effective. So it's a great thing to be able to give to the masses. And if someone feels like they need a bit of extra help, or they've tried that and they haven't quite been compliant with following what it says to do on the screen. I mean, I've seen patients who have tried an online program, but they haven't really stuck to it. It hasn't felt like it really did for them what they needed. And just having someone to speak to and to really help explain to them, well, the reason you're doing this is for this reason, and to help them to comply with what it's asking you to do, can be quite effective.
Yeah, I mean, the cynical side of me says that, you know, everything gets privatized, the health service in particular. So the government saying, okay, well, we can't afford to roll out private TBTI therapists for everybody. We just don't have the budget to do it. So we're just going to give them an app to do it. You know, that's the cynical side of me.
I think it's a realistic side there. I mean, if we had unlimited funds, the wait list for depression therapy is shocking. And some parts of the country can be up to 18 months, I've heard. And there's no way somebody who is depressed at that moment and needs help there and then can wait 18 months for depression therapy. So, you know, it's a balancing act. The NHS, I genuinely believe, is doing its absolute best by everyone, but they don't have unlimited funds. So this is, you know, Sleepio is a really good way of getting at least some help to people, rather than just saying, well, you know, you can't help you, sorry about that. We'll have these sleeping pills, which might help you very, very short term, but actually the long term effects of them are, as you know, is awful.
Yeah. Oh no, it's brilliant. It's brilliant that it's available and it's freely available. And also these kind of things are inevitable because, you know, the robots are coming and technology and a lot of jobs are going to go because of automation and online services. And so, you know, I can be cynical like this, but there is an inevitability that this will happen. But just to go back to this, there are different entry points. So you can use an app. The best, obviously, is to see someone one-on-one, such as yourself, or hopefully there's more than 10 people in the UK now.
Yeah, there are.
Or you can do it in a group as well.
Yeah, that works pretty well.
Yeah, how does that work? Doing CBTI in a group therapy setting?
In a group setting, you can do it. People can have the opportunity to ask questions about a particular thing they don't understand. But you don't get, in the CBTI group setting, the opportunity where people really open up. Because I find that when I see clients one-on-one, a lot of times they'll tell me things that even though it's not counselling, they will tell me things that are bordering on counselling that they maybe have never ever told anybody else before.
Yeah.
And it gives them an opportunity to, you know, let that go and to feel freed from those thoughts as part of it, which I think in group counselling you don't get that intimacy, but it can be very effective.
Yeah, it's obviously you'll be making a connection with other people with similar problems as well. So, you know, there's obviously a lot of benefits that are going to come to that, but I just want to give people an overview of how, you know, the different ways that they can do this.
Yes, it's just like personal training. You know, seeing a personal trainer one-on-one is arguably more effective than being in a group class, which is arguably more effective than doing online personal training.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah, I think it's the same, because with online personal training, no one's there to tell you, come on, you can do it one more. Whereas in the group training, you've got that support group, but equally, if you didn't turn up, would they really notice? You know, whereas in a one-on-one personal training, very expensive. You've paid to go. There's one person there who's, you know, rooting for you. You want him to be happy with you, so you're going to go and get a great body and get really fit, which you might not do with it online or with a book. You know, you can look at things for personal exercise in a book.
Okay, well, let's go into the nitty-gritty. What actually happens when someone with a sleep problem decides to do a program of CBT for insomnia?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to obviously tailor it to how you work with people on a one-on-one basis, but all of the things that you're going to talk about, they will also apply to what happens in the other forms, you know, the book, the app, the group as well. So there's a few technical terms. You'll probably bring them up, but I, you know, because some it is quite a technical and scientific thing. But I'm just going to let you take us on a walkthrough for a typical person approaching you with a sleep problem and how you would structure their treatment.
Well, to start with, I always want to talk to someone on the phone before we start, just to make sure that I'm really the person to help them, because often I might be able to easily help solve their issue that they might have that isn't a big insomnia that needs CBTI. And I wouldn't want to, you know, embark someone on a program of therapy if that isn't what they needed. But once we've decided that they have insomnia that's been going on for some time and it's affecting their life and they want to do something about it, then I would send them out questionnaires to rule out other disorders. Like I touched on before, if somebody has post-traumatic stress disorder or OCD that's really causing the issue, then that's the thing that needs to be sorted. Equally, if they have sleep apnea, which is, I'm sure you know, it's where people stop breathing during the night, it's incredibly dangerous left untreated. So if I see through the questionnaires or speaking to somebody that they have something else that's clearly causing their insomnia, then I'll refer them to either a sleep clinic or a psychiatrist, psychologist, back to their GP to get that looked at.
Sorry to interrupt there, but that goes back to our point of making sure who you do see actually knows what they're talking about. Because if you have got one of those conditions and it goes ignored, you could be in a lot of trouble, as you say.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with sleep apnea. Once you know about it, it's obvious. But the number of times I've spoken to somebody say, you know, do you stop breathing during the night? They're like, oh yeah, my wife's always telling me that, you know, I snore and I stop and I snore and I stop for a minute throughout the night. And, you know, alarm bells are ringing because yep. You think, you know, you might be tired during the day and think you have insomnia, but you don't have insomnia. You have sleep apnea and yep. You need a machine to keep you alive, not me. And then I will give people a sleep diary to complete for 2 weeks before I see them. Because it's really important to know what's really going on with their sleep. So a two-week sleep diary to look at what's going on during the day and what's going on at night.
It's really hard to keep a diary, isn't it? It takes discipline.
Well, I send them out a blank one so that they just sort of fill it in. But I'm looking for things like, are they eating regularly throughout the day? Are they exercising? How much caffeine are they drinking each day? How much you know, alcohol they're drinking each day, those kinds of things that if you just ask somebody, how much do you drink? They might give you a figure and say, oh, I hardly drink at all. But actually, when you're asked to write it down every day for 2 weeks, then you can actually see, oh, actually, I'm having 4 cups of coffee every day. And, you know, and then I can explain to them the impact of caffeine on sleep and move forward from there. Yeah. And exercise, if they're having any naps. Often people, you know, I've seen people who have only, you know, 5 hours sleep a night. They go to bed at 10 and they wake up at, you know, 3 in the morning and they're really stressed because they're not sleeping enough. But actually, when you do a sleep diary, they're getting a nap of an hour or two every day. Right. You know, well, add those two numbers together and you're getting 7 hours sleep. Yeah. So it's more of a sleep expectation problem there. So the sleep diary is looking at daytime behaviors, but also looking at their sleep. So when do they go to bed? When do they actually fall asleep once they've got in bed? How many times do they wake up in the night? How long are they awake for in the night? And what time do they wake up in the morning? And crucially, what time do they get out of bed? Because often people will wake up at, let's say, 5:30 in the morning, but they won't get out of bed until 7. And that's an awfully long time to be spending in bed not sleeping, which is one of the core fundamentals of CBTI. So once I've got armed with all that information, so I've ruled out medical problems, psychological issues that might be causing the insomnia, and looked at their sleep diary, you're able to look at a plan which looks at their cognitive and behavioural changes that they need to make to help them fix their insomnia.
One thing that springs to mind is that this idea of perception of sleep and sleep misperception.
Yep.
What I'm trying to get at is, can technology help in these things for tracking your sleep, or do you feel that that's actually there was some research last year about this idea of orthosomnia, where people who were tracking their sleep was actually making them worse and worry about it.
I've had experience of both of those actually. So when I was doing my doctorate, we used active watches, which are basically a very rudimental Fitbit. Back in the day, they were really expensive, but they just track movement in your arm, so they can tell you if you're awake or if you're asleep based on the fact that are you moving. And there is, depending on the devices, like Fitbits or Apple Watches or Garmins, all those various devices you could buy, they can be pretty accurate, and they can be helpful. However, people with insomnia do tend to lie very, very still because they think it's really important to give every opportunity they're trying to sleep. So they'll lie there really, really still. So your watch might well think that you're asleep, when you're not. Yeah. And then on the other side, I've had people phone me up who said, I need to see you because my Fitbit tells me I'm waking up 4 or 5 times every night. And I said to them, well, how long are you awake for? And they say, well, you know, just a minute or so. Mm. Well, that's normal. That's what, if you look at someone's sleep, that is what sleep is. Every 90 minutes, pretty much everybody wakes up throughout the night. So, but this person armed with the information is saying, my sleep's disrupted. I need to sleep in a solid block. But actually that's not true. Or another person came to see me because they phoned me up to say, I need to see you because my Fitbit's telling me I'm only getting 30% deep sleep and I need to get the whole night of deep sleep because 30% is not good enough. And I had to explain to them, 30% deep sleep is amazing. I mean, that's the most deep sleep anyone could hope to get, basically. Yeah. But sleep isn't just deep sleep, or deep sleep doesn't equal good sleep. Deep sleep is one part of this: light sleep, deep sleep, dreaming sleep.
Yeah.
But without that information, if they're being told, well, you wake up 5 times last night and you've got 25% deep sleep, then people could think, oh my goodness, that's terrible. My sleep's really disrupted and it's not enough deep sleep. And then you start to worry about sleep, start to, you know, stress about the fact that you don't think you're sleeping well. And before you know it, you can actually give yourself a real sleeping disorder because of that.
Yeah, there's actually another layer to this where the information that they're telling you, what is it actually based on? Because these aren't medical devices, they're consumer devices. But with CBTI, you say, just keep a diary.
Yeah. I if people want to look at their devices, they can, but I'd much rather, I try and tell people that they're not as reliable as you might think. Mm. And most of the devices wouldn't be allowed in a scientific journal. That's how I put it. Yeah. Like if I wanted to make a paper, I wouldn't be allowed to use these devices as supporting evidence. So I'd much rather they just had their impressions of their sleep, which is the important thing.
Mm. Maybe in 5 years, 10 years time, we might get there with these gadgets, these Fitbits, but they're not quite there yet, are they? Sorry, I interrupted your flow there. So we've got the diary. So this is the what would you call it? A pre-assessment or
pre-consultation assessment. Yeah. So then they'll send that to me before we meet and I will analyze all the information that they've given me and come up with the plan and see them and start recommending the things that I think would help them. And of which there are two major things. There's behavioral changes and there's cognitive changes to their sleep, hence the cognitive behavioral therapy. So the behavioral changes is very much looking at sleep hygiene, sleep restriction. So sleep restriction was the sort of the thing people used to do to help people with insomnia before CBTI came to the forefront of everything, which looks at cognitions as well, not just your sleep behavior. Because most of the time when people have insomnia, the reason it turns from a transitory sort of short-term insomnia that happens when you've got an exam stress or someone's just died or something bad has happened and you don't sleep well, which is perfectly normal. The reason that perpetuates and becomes, has a life of its own and turns into a big chronic insomnia that's going on longer term is because people tend to have sleep extension. They tend to try to give themselves more opportunity to sleep because, well, I didn't sleep well last night, so I'll go to bed early tonight, or I'll lie in tomorrow, or I'll have a nap. And all these kinds of things just lead to you spending too long in bed trying to sleep, too much energy trying to sleep, which increases your anxiety, increases your stress, actually means that you get less sleep than you would have done. So sleep restriction looks at looking at how much sleep you're actually getting and looking at a thing called sleep efficiency. So sleep efficiency is how efficient your sleep is. So if you went to bed at 10 o'clock and got up at 7 o'clock in the morning, but of that time, so you're in bed from 10 p.m. until 7 a.m., but of that time, you were only asleep for 6 hours. So you spent 3 of those hours, either it took you a long time to fall asleep or you woke up too early or you're awake in the night, then you would have a sleep efficiency of 66%. That means 66% of the time you're in bed, you're actually asleep. And that isn't great. What we want is your sleep efficiency, the percentage of time you're actually asleep in bed, to be as big as possible so that you're not spending large amounts of time lying there in bed being unable to sleep. And there's a really good reason for that. So have you heard of Pavlov's dog?
Yes.
So I'll just explain in case some people haven't heard of him. So Pavlov was this guy who had a dog, surprisingly. And this dog, he rang a bell. The dog did nothing because why would it? But then he rang the bell and gave the dog a treat and did that repeatedly ringing the bell, giving the dog a treat. Until before you know it, he just had to ring the bell and the dog was salivating. It was really excited. Even if the treat didn't follow, the dog had learned that this bell was a wonderful thing. I love this bell. I'm really excited. When you spend time in bed not sleeping, you're in bed and you're lying there trying to sleep and it's a stressful, anxious time. You're pairing anxiety and stress and not sleeping with your bed. So repeatedly, your bed is becoming this place where you're not asleep. You're stressed, you're anxious, it's a bad place to be. A lot of people I see, they can fall asleep on the sofa fine, or they can go to a friend's house and sleep in their bed. But when they get up from the sofa, lie down in their own bed to try to go to sleep, it's like a light's turned on, their mind's awake, and they absolutely cannot sleep. It's because their bed has become this place of anxiety and not sleep. So with sleep restriction, we try to reduce the amount of time that you spend in bed to try to stop these large amounts of time which are being wasted in bed, just not sleeping and being anxious, and also forcing your body to learn to sleep more efficiently. So sleep restriction means if your sleep efficiency is less than 85%, you reduce your sleep window, as it were. So you reduce the amount of time that you're allowed to be in bed that night. So let's say you've been, like I said in the example, you've been going to bed at 10 and getting out of bed at 7 a.m, but your sleep efficiency is only 66%. So I would push back your going to bed time to 10:30. So I'd say you're not allowed to go to bed until 10:30, and you can get out of bed at 7. And you have to set the alarm for 7 a.m. 7 days a week, and you have to get out of bed at that point. Now, for somebody with insomnia who's not sleeping enough, the idea of spending less time in bed seems ridiculous. You say, well, that's crazy because, you know, it takes me however long to fall asleep, and if I'm going to bed later, then I'm not going to sleep enough. But the point is, it will help, and it does help, because you're starting to break the cycle of anxiety and sleep. So then we move the bedtime forward. So it means that even if you're tired at 9 o'clock in the evening, you cannot go to bed until 10:30, and then you go to bed. And then after a few days, maybe your sleep efficiency is still not 85%. So then after a week, I'm going to push it back to 11 o'clock. So you're not allowed to go to bed until 11 o'clock and you get out of bed at 7. And we push it back and back and back until your sleep efficiency starts to go up, which means that your body has learned to go to bed more quickly and to sleep within that sleep window. And once your sleep efficiency starts going up, you've started to break that negative cycle of anxiety on your bed. You've started to maybe stop the middle of the night awakenings because you've been squeezing this sleep opportunity down. So you don't have now all that extra time to catch up sleep. There's no, people get stressed if even if they're getting 8 hours sleep, but if it takes them from 9 in the evening until 10 o'clock the next morning to get those 7-8 hours sleep, that's very stressful because there's all that time when you're not sleeping being stressed. What you want is to sleep in one block or near enough one block in one period of time, and this is what will help. So you've used sleep restriction to learn how to sleep in a good sleep window, and then you start to extend it back again, back to a normal going to bed and waking up time until you're getting good sleep, not spending too long falling asleep, not spending too long waking up in the middle of the night and not waking too early, and boom, you're fixed. It's easy as that.
So yeah, I mean, it sounds so well, one is it sounds counterintuitive.
Yes.
But two, it sounds almost like too simple. It's like, well, how can that work?
So what you do is there's a lot of sleep education as well involved, because I could just tell you do this and you'd be like, well, it doesn't really make sense. But I explain what sleep really is, how sleep works, your sleep drive, your circadian rhythm, all the factors that go into it, and talk about, you know, Pavlovian conditioning to really explain why we're doing this. And therefore the compliance level is much stronger. But it isn't just about sleep restriction. Like yeah. I say, it's about also about your cognitions about sleep. It's looking at other things, like your people can have an irregular sleep schedule. So some nights they might be going to bed at 10, other nights they might be going to bed at 2 in the morning. And if you're moving your bedtime and getting up time wildly, you're giving yourself jet lag, basically, and that's not helpful. Your body does its best sleep when it's at a regular going to bed and waking time.
Okay, this is just a sort of curiosity question, but what's the most extreme that you've ever restricted people's sleep?
Well, there is a limit. You shouldn't really go less than 5.5 hours. Even if somebody's, say, only getting 2 hours a night sleep, there is no way you should only give them a really small opportunity. There is a minimum.
Right. Okay. So people don't have to worry. You're not going to say, you know, have half an hour sleep tonight.
Yeah. No. I mean, 5.5 hours is still a very short sleep window. That's going to bed at 12:30 and getting up at 6. Yeah. Yeah. There is a minimum because, yeah, otherwise it would be very unhealthy.
Those are the guidelines. Do you find it's more common with regards to this idea of sleep efficiency that people are staying in bed, not asleep at the beginning of the night or in the morning, or does it tend to vary?
Oh, it's really across the board, actually. Some people have trouble getting to sleep, so they will lie in bed and try and fall asleep for 2 to 3 hours. It tends to be people who have trouble falling asleep. It tends to be that their minds are worrying, they're worrying about the next day, they're mulling over the previous day. It's very much a sort of anxiety related issue. People who wake up in the middle of the night or wake up early in the morning, that tends to be more related to maybe if it's something emotional on your mind or if someone's drinking, because often people drink to help them sleep, but actually that disrupts your REM sleep continuity. But basically the sleep restriction works whichever end of the spectrum you're having the issue, whether it's falling asleep, staying asleep, or waking up too early. The fact that you're squeezing that sleep window means that your body is having to learn to fall asleep more efficiently. But like I said, that isn't the only tool. There's also the idea that if you are lying in bed unable to sleep, you should get up out of bed and go to another room if you've been trying to sleep for, say, 15 minutes. The 15-minute rule, some people call it the 20-minute rule, but it just means that you're breaking that cycle again of anxiety in your bed. Lying in bed trying to sleep is the single least productive thing you can do when you have insomnia. And yet it's the thing everyone thinks that you should do.
Let's talk about this. This idea of stimulus control.
Yep.
CBTI is like all of these tools, and they've all been brought together. So let's talk about this idea, because stimulus control, you know, what on earth is that?
Yeah, so that's that your bedroom should be used for only sleep and sex, nothing else. You shouldn't read in bed. You shouldn't check your phone in bed. You shouldn't do work in bed. You shouldn't listen to music in bed. You shouldn't do anything else in bed, or ideally in your bedroom, other than sleep and sex, because you want, in the same way that you want to stop the Pavlovian conditioning of your of anxiety in your bedroom, you don't want to stop your bedroom being a place of anxiety. You also want to stop it being a place of awakeness. You want to start conditioning your body that your bedroom is a place of sleep. So even if you're, and that's the biggest thing, people say, well, what do you mean I can't read in bed? That's crazy. But reading in bed, even though it's relaxing and it's nice, it's still your brain is saying, we should be reading this. This book's interesting. Let's stay awake and read this book. You're giving mixed messages to your body. Your body isn't saying, oh, I'm in bed, it's time for sleep. It's saying, I'm in bed, it's time to read. Which, even though it's a nice thing, it's not what you want. You want it to be a time for sleep. When you don't have insomnia, you can do whatever you like in bed.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is to fix your sleeping problem.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds pretty hardcore. You think of just reading a book in bed. It's like, well, where's the harm in that? But what we're talking about is someone coming to you with a sleep problem.
Yeah, exactly. If I have trouble sleeping, which I rarely do, but occasionally I do, then I'll follow my own rules. And if I'm lying there awake, not being able to sleep, then I'll get up out of bed, go to another room and read there. You know, get up out of my room and go and, you know, do a puzzle or do something somewhere else so that my bedroom can then become again the place for sleep. So this sort of 15-minute rule thing that I mentioned, if there was just one thing people were going to do, just one, that would be the one I would most recommend. But it is really hard because it's 2 a.m, it's cold outside, you're snuggled up next to your partner and you're thinking, well, I'm not asleep, but at least I'm getting rest in bed and it's warm. But actually, that's not helpful, because yes, you are resting, but you would be resting in a chair in the lounge, you know?
Yeah.
And if you took yourself out of that bedroom environment into another room to do something else, you'd be fixing your sleep problem rather than perpetuating it.
Yeah. And this is one of the things when people talk about CBTI, and it's not like taking a pill. It is more like deciding to do a fitness program, because you have to do it.
Mm-hmm. And I talk about that in my sessions. I say, I'm like a nutritionist, you know, you come to see me because you want to be fitter and healthier. And I'm going to say, right, well, you need to exercise more and you need to eat less junk food. No one wants to hear that. You know, people want to hear, oh, well, actually, just have this special pill and sit on the sofa and you'll lose weight and be fit. You know, people want to come and see me and I'll say, oh, well, actually, this special spray or this, you know, just count to 20 two times and everything will be fine. No, what I'm telling them is something that's hard work. It's hard work to get up out of bed at 2 a.m. when it's cold outside.
Yeah.
But it's what you need to do to fix the problem.
Yeah. It's incontrovertible, the evidence. CBTI works.
Yeah.
If you follow the instructions.
Mm-hmm. And that's why even if they only see me face to face, like one or two times, I'm helping them, you know, over the internet, over by email, by phone, to keep them adjusting their sleep efficiency, adjusting their sleep window, making sure that they're keeping on track. Then there's the cognitive aspects of the cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah, let's go into that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So, well, one of the major problems about when people have insomnia is that they place so much stress and importance on the need to sleep. And like I said before about the people who are struggling to have a child and that they're really paying attention to things to do with babies, if you are struggling to sleep, then you'll be extra heightened and worried about the fact that you're not sleeping. So you'll get stressed, not choose to do things during the day because you don't want to, you know, stop yourself being able to sleep well. You can just be that extra anxiety at bedtime, the need to sleep, the worry about I need to sleep increases your arousal. People become heightenedly attuned to their own bodies. They'll be lying there and they'll be hyper aroused about paying attention to the cues within their own body to try and sort of see, oh, am I falling asleep? And that kind of heightened arousal of paying attention to your own body is not helping you sleep. So it's all about the sort of the worries about sleep, but also just worry in general, because people can lie down in bed and, like I said before, you can suddenly start thinking about all the worries that you have, things that you need to do tomorrow, things you didn't do today, things that you could have done better today, all those thoughts that start whirring in your mind when you're trying to fall asleep. Now, the best way of dealing with those is to make time to worry before you go to bed. Now, we're so busy. We're rushing at 100 miles an hour, trying to cram our days with everything that we have to do, that we don't make any time to stop and think about either what's on our heart or what's on our mind, or to think about what happened during the day. But your brain, all those thoughts are there and it still wants to think about them. So even if you haven't made time to think about them during the day, your brain is going to do it for you at night, either when you're trying to fall asleep, or it's going to have disrupted dreams because it's doing it during your dreaming sleep, which will wake you up and disrupt your sleep there. So make time to worry before you go to bed. That means like a couple of hours before bed, sit down with a piece of paper, and either you can do structured problem solving with an issue that you have, or just brain dump, like expressive writing is such a powerful tool. It just means just sit there for 15 minutes and just write whatever is on your mind, just to sort of brain dump it. Because the physical act of writing is so powerful to get those thoughts out of your brain. It's much more powerful than just talking about it with somebody. And then once you've made that time to think about and, you know, get rid of all those thoughts from inside your head, when you lie down to sleep, that isn't the first time that day that you've had a chance to stop and think. So therefore, you're going to allow yourself to be able to sleep at that point.
Yeah, been rushing around.
Mm-hmm.
1,000 miles an hour, and then it's, you know, you look at your watch, time to go to bed, and all of those worries, all those anxieties, all those thoughts about work, about family, about whatever, you know, your head hits the pillow.
Yeah,
boom, that's the first time you've actually had to think about
exactly.
Those
exactly. And you can take a sleeping pill to mask it, but that's not really going to help. A bit like, you know, with depression, the reason talking therapy is so good is because you're actually dealing with the issues, you're not just masking it. So you can't just take a sleeping pill or, you know, just force yourself to fall asleep. And because there's a reason your brain is having all those thoughts, it's because they're important thoughts and it needs to deal with them. And so you need to choose, do you want to deal with them at 2 a.m. or do you want to deal with them at 8 o'clock in the evening for 15 minutes? And then you're good to go.
Yeah, so you've described a little bit about the practical action steps that people can do this. You know, you say do a brain dump. Mm-hmm. I just want to give people a few little takeaways, you know, if they just want to try this out, you know, just as a single aspect of what you do in the whole of CBTI. So for instance, you say just writing things down. What are some other practical, you know, really practical things?
Like having a notebook by the bed is really helpful, because sometimes you're lying in bed and just a little thought will pop into your head, not a massive worry, but maybe, oh, I've got to pay that bill tomorrow. Then just write it down on a piece of paper next to the bed, have a notebook next to the bed, because once you've written it down, your brain knows that you've dealt with it, that it's fine. It doesn't have to keep reminding you. So have a notebook by the bed. Yeah, do that expressive writing earlier in the day. And then things like mindfulness or relaxation techniques in bed are very helpful to help you to relax. So a progressive relaxation or body scan can be really helpful. Progressive relaxation is where you're progressively relaxing your body from the toes up. It's a relaxation technique that sort of you tense different parts of your body and relax them progressively from your feet up to the top of your head. Which helps your body to physically relax as you're trying to fall asleep, but also it keeps your brain focused on what it's doing instead of all those other worries and thoughts that are going on. So I teach people a progressive relaxation technique, and that will take about sort of 10 minutes to do. And if you've done that in bed and you're still wide awake, then at that point, you use the 15-minute rule and you say, okay, get up out of bed, go to another room, do something else until you start to feel sleepy and then come back to bed again. But with the sort of cognitive aspects of insomnia, it's as well looking at sort of thought records and looking at people's thoughts and worries about the lack of sleep and saying, well, is that realistic? You know, people worry, if I don't sleep tonight, then I won't be able to work tomorrow. And you say, well, what happened last time you didn't sleep well? Were you able to go to work? And they'll invariably say, well, yes, I did. And, you know, did anything terrible happen? No, it didn't. So then you're challenging those catastrophic thoughts that are happening to show, you know, yes, you might not sleep really well tonight, but if you don't, then the world isn't going to end. You know, just the very fact of carrying on with it takes that power away from insomnia.
And that's going to be very personal, isn't it? If you're doing CBTI with an app, they'll have some sort of feedback, a bot or whatever, that will direct you through the app. But if you're doing this with someone such as yourself, a psychologist, you're going to very much tailor the types of thoughts that they're having and be able to question those directly.
Exactly. So I get them to write down in a diary of sorts their thoughts across the week that they've had, and then we look at them and we challenge them and we, you know, change them week to week. So it's very much looking at their particular things and the techniques that I talk about with regards to falling asleep or dealing with worries, anxieties. It's different depending whether the person has emotional issues on them. Not if they're, you know, clinically depressed, then I'm not the person for them and I would have referred them to a psychologist. But if it's just, you know, general smaller issues, then there are ways to sort of look at that and deal with that versus obtrusive thoughts that are just popping into your head, worries and things that need a different way of looking at them and analyzing them.
So this isn't like they go and see you and they go away, or they see you for a week and then that's it. It generally happens over a period of a few weeks. And what do you have, one meeting a week once the treatment starts?
So if somebody comes to see me and they have insomnia that's been going on for a really long time and they have a lot of negative thoughts about their sleep and it's so ingrained that it's been going on for a really long time, they need a course of CBTI, then it would take place over a number of weeks. So the first week you would start to look at their sort of sleep hygiene and get them to change their sort of their sleep window and touch on some of the other aspects. And as the weeks go on, you would bring in things like their cognitions about sleep, their thoughts about sleep and their preoccupation with sleep, get them to record their thoughts, bring in more relaxation techniques like their progressive relaxation body scan, and also do a bit more of your sort of sleep hygiene and looking at different aspects of their sleep whilst also tailoring their sleep restriction window over the weeks and then hopefully increasing it back up again. But some people don't have all that time in the world or the finances to be able to do that. And in which case, then I can help them in you know, either in one or two sessions to do a sort of a best case, you know, this is what I think is good for you. And then they can go off and either do the CBT online or in a book or continue it with the support from me remotely. Obviously, the gold standard is to come and see someone for a 6-week-ish period of a weekly or every 2-week sessions. But, you know, I'm a realist, and especially in the UK where we don't have a lot of CBTI face-to-face on the NHS, then if someone's paying for it themselves, then I really do try and help them in as short a time frame as possible that is going to be effective.
Yeah. Let's say if someone was signed up to a full program, it's going to run for, you say, what, between 4, 6, 8 weeks, that sort of time span?
Yeah, that sort of time span, yeah.
And so it's not something that's going to go on for, you know, months and months and months.
No, definitely not, no.
But as you say, there could be somebody who maybe is thinking about using an app or even getting a book, but they just wanted to speak to somebody first, and maybe they had some really pressing questions. And then, so if they came to see someone like yourself, you may in one or two sessions be able to sort of answer the things that were really concerning them, and they were able to go away.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I do try very hard to help people in as a smaller time frame as possible that is actually going to help. There's no point just seeing someone for one session if you know that's not going to help.
Yeah.
But I do make that quite clear from the start. But there is a lot of advice you can give. Maybe it's not a formal full CBTI program, but it's based on that. And if they've only got, you know, finances and ability to see someone for one session, then you can give them a good start and point them in the right direction of where they can get continued support. I think that it's important that people know that it really, really does work. There's so much scientific evidence to show that it works. And I feel like it's my job as a, you know, as a sleep expert helping people to persuade them why it works and to make them buy into it so that they do it. Because if they do it, they're going to be fixed. You know, if I do a half-baked job of persuading them why they should do it, and they don't really comply with what I've asked them to do, then they won't get better. But if they do what I've asked them to do, then I've done my job. And time and time and time and time again, people's sleeping issues that have potentially been going on for a lifetime are better, which is, you know, amazing. It gives me such huge happiness to help people to fix their sleep.
Really, really super grateful for you speaking to us today. Where can people find out more about you?
My website is troublesleeping.co.uk, and I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook at Dr. Browning Sleep. So that's at Dr. Browning Sleep. So you can follow me there and look at all various posts about sleep and my dog.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Lindsay.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. We really hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to subscribe. We're on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, all of those places. And you can also find Sleep Junkies on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, and on our Facebook group, Sleep Junkies Worldwide. That's it for this episode. See you on the next one. Sleep well.